Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and as promised, Jimmy Akin here with us this hour for Open Forum. The number's 888-318-7884, and Open Forum means open to you, open to your question, whatever it is. Whatever your status is, you're welcome here, 888-318-7884. Maybe you have a question about the Christian faith, about the Bible, about the Catholic Church, about the sacraments, any of that, that's all welcome. But maybe you have a more generally religious or philosophical question. Those are also welcome during open forum. And you don't have to be Catholic. You can be anything you want and give a call, 888-318-7884. And I'll just throw this in. When Jimmy's here, we're pretty much not turning down questions. Come on, you can ask whatever you want. You got a scientific question? You want to know about that umau mau? I think that's how you say it. Au mau mau?
Oumuamua.
Oumuamua. Oh, all right. Oumuamua. You want to know about that? Me? I'm pretty sure it was a spaceship, but whatever. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, of course, proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, among many other things that Jimmy does. Jimmy Akin, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Cyril Kellett.
I should have known you'd know how to pronounce Oumuamua.
Well, it's the word has appeared in the press.
It's weird, though. It's a weird little story.
It's a Hawaiian word.
Yeah, it's like some kind of Hawaiian deity or something like that.
Some Hawaiian thing, yeah.
But it's like this big piece of space debris that just shot through our solar system super fast.
Yeah, and there's been an astronomer named Avi Loeb who's proposed that it was extraterrestrial in or extrasolar, extraterrestrial in origin, possibly. And he's got some arguments, but he hasn't convinced everybody, and so it's a matter of speculation.
Yeah, right.
It didn't behave the way you would expect a normal asteroid to do when it swung around the sun.
Right. But it also didn't hover over American cities and blow up the White House.
Here's hoping. I mean,
because that was an awesome special effect in what was that movie now? I forgot.
Independence Day.
Yeah. 888-318-7884. I'm going to go to the phones because it's open forum. But since we're talking about Independence Day, do you notice that they blew up stuff all around the world on Independence Day? Like the aliens like shot a bunch of stuff. But did you notice they did not blow up the Taj Mahal?
I did not notice that. I've never seen the movie.
Oh, okay. So the filmmakers had a scene in there where they blew up the Taj Mahal like all these other things. But apparently, I mean, India is a huge market. And apparently Indians, people in India, they do not dig you blowing up the Taj Mahal. They like not even just for like a cool special effect. It did not go over. So they took it out. They were like, no, we're not. There's too many people there. You got to sell those tickets. Again, the number 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Call and ask whatever you like. If it's movie trivia, I'll try first, and then Jimmy can correct me, whatever the movie trivia is. Robert, in Athens, Georgia, watching on Twitch. I went on Twitch during the show yesterday, and I tried to comment. Did you see me do that, Andrew?
So you verified that Twitch exists.
I verified that it exists. Not only that, I signed up, became a member just so I could converse with people. And nobody conversed with me. Nobody said a thing to me. So, Robert, none of that is relevant to you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, y'all. I'm excited to be on. I've never asked a question before. I usually listen to through the local Athens Catholic radio channel, but today I'm on Twitch.
Well, we're really happy you're here.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I've got a question about the efficacy of eating meat from factory farming. I know the Bible and New Testament is very clear about that it's, you know, permissible and okay to eat meat in general. But I guess my question is about the ethics when the treatment of the animals being eaten is at best extremely dubious. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to ask what a Catholic perspective on that is.
Okay, well, this isn't a matter of church teaching because the church doesn't have a teaching on this question specifically. It does teach that animals should be treated in a humane manner and that they should not be subject to unnecessary cruelty. Or they shouldn't be made to suffer unnecessarily. And the church also teaches that we have, as you alluded to, it's legitimate to eat animal products, and so that's fine. But there is this concern about so-called factory farming, where animals are living in very cramped conditions, and they're not very they're being given hormones that make them grow to bizarre sizes that can impede their, you know, their normal functioning. And so there are legitimate concerns here in terms of the morality of the consumer eating animal products from a factory farm. If we apply the principles of Catholic moral theology, it's certainly arguable that factory farming should not be done in the way it is, that there are other better ways that would be more humane and that wouldn't unduly raise the price of food and so forth. Having said that, animals do not have rights, and so we're not violating the rights of animals by doing this. What we are doing is violating our own nature. When an animal is mistreated, it displays a brokenness in human nature. At the same time, it would be very hard for me to mount a case that it is forbidden to eat meat that comes from such a farm, precisely because animals ultimately don't have rights, and also because of the principles of cooperation with evil. We live in a world of sinners, and everyone you interact with here in this world is a sinner, and anyone you give business to, someone in the economic chain is going to do something inappropriate, either in obtaining money or in spending money. It's just not possible to detach oneself from people who either are doing or have done or will do sinful things in connection with money that you give them. And so moral theologians have examined that question and said that it is legitimate to cooperate with an evil that someone else is doing. So this is not an evil that you're doing, but it can be legitimate to cooperate with an evil that someone else is doing, providing that the cooperation is remote, meaning that you're not doing it yourself, and provided that there is a corresponding good that justifies the toleration of the evil. So if you need to eat, and you don't have non-factory farm food available to you, or labeled as non-factory farm food, or if it's way more expensive, then it can be perfectly legitimate to eat food from a factory farm, even though it may have been produced in a way that is undesirable.
Robert, thanks. A whole bunch of folks on the line, so I'm going to let that lie there. But I hope that was helpful to you. While Jimmy was answering, I checked the Hindustan Times, and it was Independence Day Resurgence, the second movie, not the first movie, where they decided to take out destruction of the Taj Mahal. Ray in Texas.
I've even more not seen that one.
I've even more. Maybe didn't even know that it existed. Ray in Texas listening on Armor of God Radio. Thank you for your call, Ray. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, yeah, so I'm a holdover from last hour, so mine's in the vein of Catholic moral teaching as it relates to sexuality.
Okay.
I'm having a hard time with what I perceive to be an internal inconsistency with Catholic moral teaching with respect to the marital act within marriage without using artificial contraception. That is, it's permissible to use NFP and Billings and all those different things to either achieve or avoid pregnancy, but committing other acts within the marital relation, not using artificial contraception to avoid pregnancy, are considered immoral. And that seems a little a distinction without a difference, right? The end result is the same. It's a marital act, but one's permissible, one's not.
Okay. Let me ask you a question, Ray. So suppose you and your wife have determined that it is not the proper time for you to have a baby, but your wife gets pregnant anyway. And so could you then wait until the baby is born and then kill the baby? Would that be a legitimate way of not having a baby?
No.
Okay. And how about abortion? If your wife is pregnant, she's got a baby in her womb, could you kill the baby in that circumstance?
No.
Okay, so what we've established is that there you can have a legitimate goal of not having a baby, but not all means are acceptable as a way of achieving that goal. So, you know, in the cases that I just mentioned, there are other means that you could use, like adopting the baby, you know, having the baby adopted so you and your wife no longer have the baby. That would be an acceptable means. But killing the baby either before or after birth is not an acceptable means. So what this highlights for us is that the end does not justify the means. So it can be legitimate to have the end of not having a baby right now, but that doesn't justify every possible means. And some means are not acceptable towards that end. So what we need to do is think about what means are acceptable and what are not. What makes something an acceptable means, what makes something an unacceptable means. And after reflecting on the question, the Catholic Church has said, okay, if the means you are using to continue to have marital relations and yet not have a baby, if the means operate in a way that is consistent with the way God designed human sexuality, like having intercourse during periods of the month where the wife is not fertile, then that's legitimate because you're working with God's plan for human sexuality. God planned that women would not be fertile all the time, and yet he also planned that in human beings, women would be sexually receptive even when they're not fertile. And that's not the same in all species. In many species, the only time females are sexually receptive is when they're fertile. But he, by his design, that's not the case for human beings. And so it's legitimate for humans to have marital relations during infertile periods. But the church has said, okay, what's not acceptable is means of achieving the end of not having a baby that interfere with God's design for human sexuality. And interference could take a number of forms. It could take the form of a permanent sterilization or a temporary sterilization. Both of those frustrate or interfere with the design God built into human nature. Similarly, putting barriers in place that interferes with the design God put into human nature, so would be killing the child. And so the basic distinction, at least in the church's view, is between those means to achieve the desired end that work with human nature versus those that frustrate the design that God put into us. And so there, from the church's perspective, there is a distinction here, and it's a meaningful distinction. And when you think about it in those terms, I think it becomes more understandable.
Ray, thank you. That brings us right up to the break. So we'll take that break. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. The number is 888-318-7884.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio with Matthew Bunsen. Join us every week as we talk with the Register's expert writers and editors about the news you need to know and offer authentic Catholic insights on the important stories that impact your life. Register Radio, every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern and Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. All the lines are full, which means we got tons of fun to have. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and it's open forum. So lots and lots of great questions, I am sure, coming up. This one comes from Anna in Oregon, listening on the great modern day Catholic radio. Anna, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. I wanted to ask a question for a while now. I come from, I have a Protestant background and I'm a convert. And so when my, let's say, grandma found out I started going to Catholic Church about 6 years ago, she was shocked. She was like lost for words because what they believe is that the Catholic Church used to persecute Christians. So I wanted to ask you, because I had a little trouble with my research, if that's true or not. The way I heard is that state protected the church and they supported the church. And so I just want a little history and how the church played a role in that, like if there's any chance the church was supporting that, you know. Specifically John Huss comes to mind because that's I know some Protestants talk about him, of him being at the stake,
Right. So the church clearly does not persecute, have a let's persecute Christians policy, and it never has, because the Catholic Church is the majority Christian denomination on earth. It's the organic continuation of Christ's original church, and so it would be absurd for the Catholic Church to have a policy of let's persecute Christians. Having said that, there are different forms of belief in God, and some forms claim to be Christian while actually advocating ideas that are contrary to the Christian faith. And movements that do this are known as heresies. If it's a movement that claims to be Christian but nevertheless teaches things that are contrary to the Christian faith, then it's a heretical movement, and it can be dangerous to have heretical ideas spreading. This is something, for example, that we saw in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, before Christian times, you know, God had called Israel to worship him and not to worship other gods. If you were going to be an Orthodox, meaning a correctly believing Israelite, you needed to worship Yahweh, the God of Israel, and not other pagan deities and idols and things like that. And it could be very dangerous spiritually to have the idea spreading in the Jewish community that it was okay to worship pagan deities and idols like Baal or Asherah or Ashtaroth or Molech or these other deities. And so to protect the people of Israel from false worship like this, God insisted at the time that such people be expelled from the Israelite community, even on pain of death, and as a way of protecting the community from these spiritually destructive, religiously destructive practices. And when the Christian age began, there was something similar that happened, because you had heretical groups of Christians springing up. Some of them, like in the early centuries, for example, there was a movement that is now known as Gnosticism. And Gnostics would say things like, you know, Jesus and his Father and the Holy Spirit, they're not the only gods. There are these other beings called eons. And really, Jesus, he's just like the lowest of the eons. But there are all these other eons. And actually, the eon that made the world, he was a bad, broken god. So instead of the world being good, made good, like it says in Genesis, it actually is this bad, broken world. And we should be concerned religiously with reuniting ourselves with these other eons. And that meant that they were, you know, having a radically different vision of the Christian faith than what Jesus taught. And that has spiritual consequences if you believe that. And so early Christians, you know, insisted on excluding Gnostics from the Christian community. In the Middle Ages, after the Greco-Roman world and the European world had become Christian, after the state had become Christian, there was it became hard to just kick these people out of society because you couldn't, you know, easily just export them. And an argument was made, partly based on the Old Testament passages that refer to being willing to use lethal force to defend the community against these false beliefs. And it was argued, for example, by St. Thomas Aquinas, that it was legitimate to use lethal force in order to protect the Christian community from heresies, on the grounds that, well, if one person murders another, then it is legitimate to put the murderer to death. But heresy is even worse than physical murder, because heresy doesn't just kill the body, it kills the soul. And people who end up believing the heresies can be eternally lost, which is much worse than being murdered. Because if you're murdered, you'll get your body back in the resurrection. But if you go to hell, there's no escape. There's no compensation that's going to happen at some point. And so, given that the spread of heretical ideas was perceived as being worse than physical murder, people in this period were willing to use lethal force to protect the Christian community against the spread of heretical ideas. Now, normally that was not done by the church itself. The church itself didn't have political power. The church itself didn't put people to death. But it was the case that Catholic officials would encourage the state to apply capital punishment in these cases, just like it would apply capital punishment in other cases. In the instance of John Hus, or Jan Hus in particular, he was an individual who attended the Council of Constance in the 1400s, and he advocated ideas that were regarded as heretical. Like other people in this period, he was given a chance to back off and you know, renounce these ideas and you know, cease spreading them, and he refused to do that, and as a result, he ended up being executed. Now, you can look at that and say that was a mistake, that shouldn't have happened, but you can understand the fundamental motive that was being applied here, which was trying to protect people's souls from the spread of heretical ideas. And this motive was not unique to Catholics. After the Protestant Reformation began, it was also employed in the Protestant community, who martyred various Catholics. Like, for example, St. John Fisher and St. Thomas More were both put to death in England because of their Catholic beliefs. And the Protestant community in England felt like they were trying to protect the Protestant community from Catholicism. And they aren't the only ones. John Calvin in Geneva had an individual put to death, and there were various other places in the Protestant world that this happened. And so in looking back on this, we can say this was unfortunate. We can say that we wouldn't do this today. We could even, you know, argue that it was a mistake for them to do this. But they were proceeding from a fundamentally good motive on both sides, which was trying to protect the community from what they regarded as very dangerous ideas that could lead people to lose their eternal salvation. And so, regardless of what you think about what they did, we can acknowledge that both Catholics who had heretics executed and Protestants who had people they regarded as heretics executed were proceeding in a way that they were trying to protect the Christian community. We can also say that you can't simply unilaterally tar the Catholic Church with this, because it's not something that was uniquely Catholic. It's something that happened in other Christian communities too, including in the Protestant community. They also executed people they regarded as heretics, including Catholics.
What do you think, Anna?
Oh, thank you so much. That was very helpful. And very, very clear.
All right. Thank you, Anna.
Awesome.
I appreciate that. Let's head out to Los Angeles. Josh in Los Angeles watching on YouTube. Josh, you got a question for Jimmy?
Oh, here we go. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Very well. Thank you.
So I am in RCIA, and I plan on being baptized in the Catholic Church next Easter. And
awesome.
I was having a conversation with someone. Oh, thank you. I was having a conversation with someone about the fact that I'm joining the church, and they were asking me why. And one of my reasons that I cite is I really am attracted to the centrality of the Eucharist in the Catholic practice, you know, in the Mass. And this person raised an objection that kind of, you know, I don't know why, but I felt like I couldn't answer it immediately. Mm-hmm. She said that she had a problem with the fact that the Catholic Church denies communion to Christians who are not Catholic, for instance, or to people who are divorced or such things. And she said that the reason that she said that she found this to be outlandish is she brought up the fact that Jesus did not deny, communion, the Eucharist, to Judas.
Okay. Josh, I'm going to leave that right there and let Jimmy address that when we come back, because the music's playing, so that means we got to go for a quick minute. We'll be right back. We'll get an answer to your question, Josh, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, make it work.
Feeling stuck in your life or relationships? We'll help you find some answers.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. I really got into it that time. Really got into the groovy music that time. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And on the line is Josh in Los Angeles, coming into the church, hoping to receive the sacraments at Easter in the coming year. And faced with a question that's troubling, Josh said, that is, why does the Catholic Church deny communion to other Christians, to people who are divorced? And in other circumstances, I think he was alluding to, a variety of situations, when Jesus didn't deny communion to Judas. And Jimmy Akin, you were about to answer.
So in the first place, we don't know that Judas received communion at the Last Supper. It does not say that he received communion at the Last Supper. And you could try to infer that based on the sequence of when Judas leaves. But there's a problem there, too, which is that the information we have tells us what occurred during the Last Supper, but not necessarily what order it occurred in. And this is true of ancient documents in general. People didn't have, recording devices that they would use to record the exact sequence of events. And so what they would have happen is they would remember that something occurred, but not remember the exact order in which things always occurred. And so when they wrote history, they would they would tell us what happened, but we can't rely on that to tell us exactly when it happened. So people remembered that Jesus distributed communion to the apostles at the Last Supper. They also remembered that Judas was at the Last Supper. They remembered that Judas left the Last Supper, but exactly when Judas left with respect to communion is something that we really don't know, because the texts aren't sufficiently precise to tell us that. And also, they present some of the things in relation to the meal in a slightly different order. If you look at Luke, for example, compared to Matthew and Mark, Luke indicates that that the sequence of events, or if you took Luke as absolutely precise in its chronology, you would run into a conflict between Luke and Matthew and Mark, because Matthew and Mark record the same events, but record them in a slightly different order. And if you look at John, well, he's got the Last Supper, and he records Judas leaving, but he doesn't mention communion at all in his account of the Last Supper, because he's trying to supplement the Synoptic Gospels and mention things they don't go into. So since all of the Synoptic Gospels already discussed the Eucharist, John does not discuss the Eucharist in his account of the Last Supper, because he's filling in other material you wouldn't know. So so we don't know that Judas received communion is point number one. Point number two is that St. Paul, who is also an inspired author, indicates that there are people who are Christians and who should not be receiving communion. He talks about how if you receive communion unworthily, that there can be consequences. He tells the Corinthians that because they were receiving communion unworthily, there were many among them who were weak or sick or who slept, meaning they had died, because sleep is a euphemism for death. And so there can be very serious consequences if you receive communion when you shouldn't. And it's, of course, the duty of the church to tell people, if the church knows about a circumstance that it's not safe to receive communion in, the church has an obligation to warn people, just like St. Paul does. St. Paul is warning people against communion, against receiving communion when they shouldn't receive it, when they're not in a state of grace and they're not receiving reverently. He therefore says, you know, you should examine yourself before you receive communion. Well, what are some of the things that you should examine yourself for? Well, despite what Josh's friend said, the Catholic Church does not deny communion to people who are divorced. You can be divorced, you can receive communion, you can get divorced one day, walk into a Catholic church, and receive communion, because divorce itself is not automatically sinful. There are situations where, in order for the sake of the spouses or the family more broadly, it can be necessary to divorce. And so divorce is not automatically sinful, and therefore the fact that you are divorced does not mean that you can't receive communion. Where there is a concern is when someone has divorced and is presumably still married to their first spouse, and then they start sleeping with another person. Even if they've got civilly remarried to that person, they're sleeping with one person when they are presumed to be married to someone else. And that's adultery. And that's why in each of the three Synoptic Gospels, it's in Matthew, it's in Mark, and it's in Luke, it's also in Romans, it's in Romans 7, for example, there are warnings, including coming from the lips of Jesus himself, about divorce and remarriage resulting in adultery. And if you're in a state of adultery, then you're in a state of grave sin in which you should not be receiving communion. And so it's the Catholic Church is simply being faithful to its commission to teach what Jesus taught, that if you're divorced and presumably married to one person, and you are sleeping with someone else, that is presumptively adultery. And if an adultery is a grave sin, if you do it knowingly and deliberately, it's a mortal sin. It's right there in the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not commit adultery. And St. Paul indicates that if someone's in a state of grave sin, they should not be receiving communion for their own safety. Subsequent to the apostolic age, the church has further reflected on the significance of communion and what it means to receive Eucharistic communion, and the church has discerned that it's a sign of full, that Eucharistic communion is ordinarily a sign of full ecclesiastical communion, saying we're part of the same church, we share the same faith, we share the same beliefs, and so we receive Christ's body and blood together. And to the extent that other Christians are in that kind of communion with the Catholic Church, it's possible for them to receive the Eucharist in a Catholic setting. So, for example, people from Eastern Orthodox communities, they share almost all of the same beliefs that the Catholic Church does. They share the same sacraments. They share the same ways of doing things to a very high degree. The same is true for other Eastern Christians, like the Assyrian Church of the East and various other groups. And so it is possible for them to receive communion in a Catholic church when they request to do so. With our Protestant friends, unfortunately, there is a much greater degree of difference, and there is a lesser degree of ecclesiastical communion. Many Protestants do not even believe that the Eucharist is the body and blood of Christ. They do not have the same sacraments. They have a wide diversity of beliefs on other matters, and so because we don't share as much in common, it is only possible for Protestants to receive in lesser circumstances. It is possible if a Protestant is in danger of death or other grave necessity and cannot approach a minister of their own communion and shares the church's belief in the Eucharist, well, then the Protestant can receive, but it's in more restricted circumstances. So that's kind of an overall sketch of how the church approaches the subject. You could argue, you know, maybe the church ought to modify its law regarding the exact circumstances in which a Protestant could receive, but fundamentally the principles are clear. If someone does not believe in the sacrament in the same way, if they are in a state of mortal sin, then they shouldn't be receiving, and that's for their own good.
Josh, I'm going to leave it there because the lines continue full. I hope that was helpful for you. Thank you very, very much. I would like to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It, as you prepare to enter the church. I'm sure you will find that book very, very helpful. So if it's something that you would like, hang on the line. Edgar will send you a copy. Going down to Louisiana now. Scotty in Louisiana watching on YouTube. You are next. You there with us, Scotty?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
All right. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah. First off, Mr. Jimmy, love your
his mysterious world
stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome!
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm almost done finishing up with the FBI secrets video.
Glad you're enjoying it. Yeah. That's a reference to a break-in in 1971 where a group of citizens were concerned the FBI was up to no good, and they broke into an FBI office and got proof.
That's the one. So
yeah.
I'm a cradle Catholic, but mm-hmm. in the last recent years, I've really been tested on my faith as a young adult. And one thing that I keep getting with a lot of my Protestant friends is the difference idea of church. And my understanding is that the church is, in of itself, its own separate entity, not the combination of people, as it seems like our Protestant brothers and sisters have. So, but my larger question really is, what's really the point of Mass? Because I've just kind of gone and absorbed and done it, you know, but at the same time, I've never really asked, like, okay, well, what's the big... What is the main reason to do it? Because I understand the Eucharist, But is there any greater reason as to give to somebody? Like, I have friends that just don't go to Mass on Sundays.
So why should they go?
Okay, well, what do I say to them?
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Why should they?
Jimmy?
Well, there are multiple reasons to go to Mass. It's Christ's will that his followers meet together regularly. This is something that's stressed in the New Testament. It's implicit in many passages, but it's also explicit in some, like in the book of Hebrews, for example. It says, the author of Hebrews says to the readers, let us not abandon the assembling of ourselves together, as is the custom of some. So the author of Hebrews were aware that even though it was the custom of Christians to meet together, to assemble together as a body in order to worship God, that some had abandoned that practice. And he's saying that is bad. We need to meet together as a community. The same thing is implicit in St. Paul's writings, for example, in Romans 12 and in 1 Corinthians 12 to 14, where Paul talks about how we as the body of Christ have been given spiritual gifts by the Holy Spirit so that we can serve each other as Christians. So you will have a gift that the Holy Spirit has given you that will enable you to serve other Christians. Other Christians have gifts that they have received that will enable them to serve you. And so if we simply never meet with other Christians, if we don't go to church, then we will be denying other people the gifts that God has given us, and we will be cutting ourselves off from the gifts of others that God has given others that we need. So it's God's will that we assemble together on a regular basis to worship God. Worshiping God corporately as a group has benefits in addition to worshiping God individually, you know, on your own. And we should do both. We should both worship God on our own and worship God as a group, as Christians. Now, furthermore, Jesus, in instituting the Eucharist, indicated that we were to do it on a regular basis. And so it's natural for Christians, when they meet together, at least regularly, to celebrate the Eucharist. And so that became very quickly, in the first century, a prominent part of Christian worship services. In terms of when we should assemble together, well, we have a precedent in the Old Testament, setting aside one day a week for rest and for the worship of the Lord. In the Old Testament, that day was Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath. But when Christianity began, Christians began meeting on the first day of the week, which is Sunday, and they began referring to it as the Lord's Day because it was the day on which the Lord Jesus rose from the dead. And so, for example, we see St. Paul in 1 Corinthians telling the Corinthians, he's arranging for a collection to be taken up so he can bring it to Jerusalem. And he tells the Corinthians that they should set aside, you know, the money that they've determined to give every day on the first day of the week. That's because that's the day that Christians met. And so Paul is expecting Christians to meet on the first day of the week and to set aside a collection, you know, at that time. And this is one of a number of reasons that that God wants us to gather together as Christians and to do so regularly and by apostolic tradition. We do that on Sundays, and by apostolic tradition, the Eucharist is celebrated as part of that service. So the Eucharist is one reason, but there are these broader considerations as well, including making sure we have adequate time for rest and worship as Christians, making sure we have time to corporately worship God, and making sure that we have the opportunity to minister to each other and to be ministered to as Christians. So we're not meant to go this alone. We're meant to go it as a group, and that's God's will. And correspondingly, the church's law, in addition, has established that we need to do this at least a certain minimum. We need to go every Sunday and holy day of obligation. And, you know, we can go every day if we want, but kind of a minimum is, okay, at least every Sunday and holy day of obligation, we want people getting together for Mass, and that's to our good, and it honors God.
Scotty, thank you very much for the question. I hope the answer was helpful. We got to go to the break. We'll take a very quick break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
EWTN Radio posts 11 podcasts every weekday and over 60 per week. They're the perfect companion for the busy Catholics everywhere. With on-demand access to audio, you can pause and pick up right where you left off anytime, anywhere, and they're all free. Subscribe by going to EWTNradio.net, then click on podcasts. They're waiting for you. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Thimble Theater. Oh, no, this is Catholic Answers Live. I got confused for a second. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Jimmy was just telling me at the break about the of course Jimmy can do this, about the origins of the character Popeye in a comic strip called Thimble Theater.
Which originally was about, like, Olive Oil and her brother or father Castor Oil and the other members of the oil family. And then eventually Popeye was introduced as a character, and he was kind of the breakout character and became very popular, and it launched the cartoon and film franchise.
Was he in the Thimble one, was he kind of mumbly? Because in the TV show, I don't know what he's saying.
Yeah, he did get lines and so forth, but he was a kind of disreputable, kind of awkward character to a significant degree.
Jordan in East Texas, you're up next. Jordan's watching on YouTube. Go ahead, Jordan, with your question for Jimmy.
Hello. So I just became a public school teacher.
Uh-huh.
And my question is, how can I be a good Catholic school teacher in a secular school?
Well, so what grade level do you teach?
I teach third grade social studies.
Oh, I didn't know they had social studies in third grade. Okay. You can, I mean, it's going to depend on your school district. Now, you're in East Texas, which probably means that you have a school district that is more friendly to expression of the Christian faith than, say, some other school districts might be, like here in California or up in New York or places like that. So that's an asset you have in your favor. You could do things like wear a cross or talk about the Christian faith and even the Catholic faith specifically when it's relevant to the lessons. You can answer questions the students may have about the faith, whether concerning the Christian faith more broadly or the Catholic faith in particular. You obviously want to stay within, what the public school system will allow you to do. But basically, I would just say bear witness to your faith in the ways that are possible, and live out your Christian values in the classroom. You know, don't do anything that conflicts with your Christian values, but live them out to the fullest extent you can. Since it's a public school, you obviously can't be as forthcoming or as aggressive, if to put it that way, as you could in a private school, in a religious school. But you can, you know, to a significant degree, you know, let your religious identity be known and live out your values.
All right. Can I ask one quick second question?
Did you raise your hand?
Go ahead.
Oh. I ask that so much that my voice is gone now.
All right.
What's your second question?
My second question is, am I correct in saying to a Protestant friend that the sacraments are not necessary for God to work the grace, they're just the ordinary means by which he means?
That is a good way of expressing it, yes.
Okay.
Nice, Jordan. You're a good teacher. It's obvious. It's clear.
Well, thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Have you got a copy of Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life?
I definitely do not.
Well, you.
But I would love to.
All right. Well, we can mail to East Texas. So hang on. We'll get your address and we'll send you a copy. Thanks very, very much for the call. Thanks for raising your hand. John in Kansas City, Missouri is next listening on the Catholic Radio app. We're glad you're here. John, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Jimmy, this morning at sunrise, or actually when the Earth was rotating on exact axis at 1,000 miles per hour and we were passing the sun, the thought came to me that Copernicus, who came before Galileo, said that the Earth rotated around the sun, and he didn't get into trouble. Mm-hmm. Galileo said the same thing, and he got into trouble. So Galileo must have said something else besides that. Is the Church mm-hmm. getting a bad rap because of how it handled Galileo when Copernicus wasn't even corrected?
Well, I think that, and if you consult historians of science, whether they're, you know, regardless of their beliefs. I mean, this, you know, atheist or, you know, agnostic historians of science will indicate that, yeah, there is a kind of black legend around Galileo that developed in later years. And it, you know, you can look at both sides of this and say, okay, there were some problems on both sides. And therefore, you shouldn't just portray the Catholic Church as being an evil ogre, because it wasn't being an evil ogre. In the case of Copernicus, there, and I don't have time to go into a big history of this because we're just about at the end of the show, but Copernicus didn't get in trouble in part because he didn't insult the Pope, whereas Galileo, who originally had the Pope as his friend, published a book called The Dialogue Concerning the Two World Systems, and the Pope had asked that Galileo not claim for a fact that he had proved that the Earth orbits the Sun, which in fact he had not proved, and in fact technically the Earth does not orbit the Sun. It orbits the heavy center, or the barycenter of the solar system, which is not always inside of the Sun. A good bit of the time it's not. The Pope also asked that Galileo include arguments for the geocentric system in his book so that people could read the arguments for both sides and make their own conclusions. And so Galileo said, I'll do that. And he then, in his dialogue between different characters, named one of the characters Simplicius, which means fool. And he put all of the geocentric argument, all of the geocentric arguments, which the Pope wanted to see, in the mouth of the character named Simplicius. So you have the Pope's position being mocked, in essence, and that kind of rubs some folks the wrong way. And it's one of the principal reasons that Galileo got in trouble. He was not cautious. He was advancing new arguments, and the Church didn't have a problem with that, but he was dogmatic about them, and he did so in an insulting way. And it turns out he was right about some stuff, but he wasn't right about everything. Some of the stuff he was dogmatic about, he was actually incorrect on.
And that is about going to do it. So I'll thank you very much for the question. I hope that answer was helpful to you. Jimmy, what's dropping tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Tomorrow we're looking at the life of the sleeping prophet, a man named Edgar Cayce, who would go into a trance and diagnose people's illnesses and recommend treatments and also obtain other psychic information about them.
Check it out tomorrow. Check it out any Friday. Well, you can check it out right now. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. There's hundreds of episodes available. But if you want to get the new episodes, they drop every Friday. Jimmy, thanks. We'll see you next week. And we'll actually see you in person next week, because we'll see you at the conference.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, wear your flannel. We got the flannel panel coming up tomorrow. Joe Heschmeyer. who we have occasionally mocked for the quality or the just the color and whatnot of his shirts. He'll be there. Chris Check will be there. I'll be there. We'll talk about the news of the day from a Catholic perspective tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live. See you then. God willing.